Recording in progress.
Got
Hello
it.
everyone, this is Rory from the Lost Root Podcast. Today is a special day. I'm joined by a wonderful guy, someone that I've really loved a lot over the years and admired a lot, who I met a number of years ago. And he is one of my original inspirations for changing my diet and my life, as his YouTube channel used to say, change your diet, change your heart, change the planet or something like that. I can't remember the exact phrase. But I'm joined by Tim Van Orden. And Tim is a guy that has some incredible achievements. He is, as a runner, just as one part of his life, as a runner, he has some amazing achievements. American record for, I've got the list here from Tim's website, American record for the 50 plus road mile, 17 US Masters and senior gold medals, two-time US Masters Trail Runner of the Year, two-time US Masters Mountain Runner of the Year, US Champion Snowshoe Half Marathon 2017, fourth in the Stair Climbing World Championships. And I'm sure there's more to that, but what the interesting thing is, I've never really heard you shout from the rooftops about any of these achievements. And I would say, if someone, and maybe this, I don't know if this is a compliment or not, it might not be, if someone bumped into you in a place and started speaking to you, I don't think they would go, this guy's probably an incredible, like, Masters champion athlete. There's not that arrogance about you or whatever that people might associate with that. And yet you've achieved these amazing things. And I'd also like to say that Tim has had a YouTube channel for many years and put out a tremendous amount of helpful videos. And I believe that he still coaches and helps people with various aspects of their life and diet. And Tim is one of the best ever speakers that we've ever had in the movement of raw food, veganism, healthy living, all that stuff. He is a really very powerful presenter. So, Tim, would you like to say anything else more about yourself? An introduction?
Well, I was wondering who you were talking about there, and then it turns out it was me. So the ironic thing is, Ronnie, that one could think that I must think pretty highly of myself due to my resume, but I have continued to go after big national titles and records and things like that because my profound insecurity makes it very difficult for me to believe that I've done enough for anyone to take interest. Not interest in me and not interest in my athletic career, but interest in the movements or choices that I have made that I think have value, like eating a vegan diet. Running Raw, the original project I started in 2006, it wasn't about, hey, look at me, I'm going to become an elite athlete. It was, I'm going to eat a raw vegan diet and see what's possible as a man in his 40s attempting to become an athlete on this diet that most would consider deficient and restrictive. But I suspect that it's going to yield some performance benefits. Let's find out what happens. I don't know. And so in 2006, that was the mission. Let's see what I can do. And now it's 19 US championships later. Wow. And I've, in the past year, turned myself into a cross-country or Nordic skier as an experiment yet again. And I was fourth at the World Championships last year, 1.8 seconds behind second place.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest surprise to me because I've been skiing for a year and a half now. And I wanted to see if I could apply the same principles that I applied to running, if I could apply them to an entirely different sport and get similar results, and the answer is yes.
So, in the world of athletics, you'd be described as a beast.
Yeah, I hear that.
You're a killer, you're a, whatever the word is, but it's funny because there's these words like that, and you see a lot of stuff when people look at content for motivation about high level achievement, and especially in athletics and physical stuff, it's very like there's an aggression to it. There's like there's this sort of like I don't know, like go out and destroy yourself, like go out, I don't know, it's like a really macho sort of whatever. And a lot of those guys, people like you and other people that I've met, would absolutely eat those guys up, but with a smile on your face. And like, you know, like, no, it's just so funny to me. Like, there's different ways that people find that elite level of performance. It's not always about this. And I think I've heard you speak about that you're not so much of a fan of some of the things that you hear out there about, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. And this is something that I hear on a regular basis, that I'm a badass or a beast. I've heard that. Right. Or a machine. I've heard people locally call me the machine. That's how I'm known in this town. And when you say, you know, this no pain, no gain, or mind over matter attitude, very strict, you know, man up, harden the F up.
Yeah, don't be a pussy.
Yeah, that's not just something that I disagree with as an outside way of going about it, but it's also something that I've employed myself in the past. And now I'm very much, I don't want to say going back on who I was when I started this whole endeavor, but I've learned so much that now my experiment is not to try to hold on to whatever athletic ability I can as I age. I'm going to be 55 in 6 months, but it's okay, let's see how much more gentle I can become and get even better. So rather than toughening up and bracing myself for this inevitable decline as I age, it's like, well, how about I just get more and more relaxed and more gentle and more curious and more detached from the results? And I have a suspicion that that's going to actually improve my performance. And that has proven to be the case.
And that's fascinating because I think that a lot of people would suggest you need to like have a specific goal and a specific plan and be disciplined, and like doesn't matter if you don't feel like going out and running or going out and training, you just got to do what you don't want to do, and yeah. Doesn't matter how you feel and all that stuff. And yeah, I get the feeling that that's not you.
Not at all. Not anymore. No. Used to be. And here's the thing, Ronnie. When I did that, I came out with a video series in 2012 called, maybe 2011, called Getting Started. And that was at a point in my career where I was attempting to hold on to my stair climbing status. Up until that point, I was one of the best stair climbers in the world and arguably the best in the country. And this is running up buildings like the Empire State Building or the Sears Tower in Chicago, things like that. And I just wasn't doing the training because it's so hard and so painful that if there was any mental fluctuation at all, if any new stressor showed up in my life, the thing that would give was my training, because it was just, it was brutal. And I've got videos on YouTube from 2010, 2011 of me doing these just insanely painful training sessions and hating every minute of it. And so in 2011, I got to the point where I just stopped training altogether. And it had been weeks. It was in December, and I deal with seasonal affective disorder. When the light goes down this time of year and it gets dark early and cold, it's been below zero every morning for the past week and a half. It's just, it's a tough time of year.
Yeah.
And I was just stuck, and I thought, uh-oh, I think I'm done here. I think the Running Raw project has come to an end, and so have I, my relevance, because if the project disappears, then I disappear along with it. So I reached out to YouTube and I said, okay, hey, I'm going to give this one last shot. And hopefully by holding myself accountable to you, my audience, maybe I can muster enough willpower and determination to do what's necessary and just try to get one more good race out of me. And that is so opposite of who I am now. I can't remember a day where I didn't train at least an hour. Most days it's 2 to 3 hours. So far in October, I've trained 100 hours just in October. Wow. I've logged 800 hours for the year so far today. I just looked because I thought, I think I might be close to 800 hours for the year. And that was today. And I never push myself. I don't have a plan or a to-do list of exercise anymore. I just allow myself to gently move into whatever my body feels that it wants to do. I get out of the way, and it guides me to, on average, 3 hours of training a day. And
do you think that you could have started like that? Or do you think the experience you had prior and, you know, getting to the point you got to allows you to do that now? Or do you think you could have always done that?
Well, there's two different things to consider. To answer that question. One is, could my body have done it? And the answer is yes. The second thing is, did I have an awareness of my identity to the degree that I do now? And the answer is no. So it's not just, has my body transformed itself to the point where now I can do this? This would have been possible all along. And I know that because this is how I coach people now. So I coach people to follow this kind of free-range, off-leash approach to physical engagement. Like, basically, just let your child run and scream when it wants to run and scream. Like, if my child wants to go run up a mountain, which it did before this call, I let it go. I can feel myself itching that it needs to move. And it's like, all right, I guess we're going to go move now. And the way that that happens is that you have to recognize that your identity, your will, your goal setter, your reputational self is just a small part of who you are. It's not you in your entirety. I mean, we have many different versions of ourselves, and we all know that if we spend any time thinking about it or looking back at our experiences, especially when it comes to diet. I witness my family on a regular basis whenever we have dinner. One of them will say something like, I cannot have seconds. I've got to start losing weight. That's it. I'm just going to eat one helping. 5 minutes later, they're over at the stove putting a giant thing of food on their plate. And I'm like, I thought you weren't going to have seconds. Well, it's been a hard day. I worked a lot, you know, and it's going to be cold tonight. And I just, you know, I need it. It's like, well, you didn't need it 5 minutes ago. Like, what just happened? Yeah. Who's in charge? Who are you really? Are you this singular thing that you think yourself to be, or are you a multiplicity? And the answer is that we, as human beings, are a multiplicity of characters. We just have a general sense of self, but it's so inconsistent. And identity is one part of that. Our reputational storyteller, goal setter, is just one part of that. And if I step around that person when it comes to diet or when it comes to physical engagement, there's very little that I can't do. But if I put that guy in charge, well, he's got really low self-esteem. He's incredibly insecure. He's got something to prove. He thinks that he needs to push hard. He thinks that every workout he does needs to be impressive. He's going to break my body. He's going to bury me. He's going to get depressed. He's going to be disappointed if he doesn't win the race. So I can't put him in the driver's seat. So who do I put in the driver's seat? The part of me that just is a being in the world and loves to play, loves to engage, loves to move, loves to watch ski races on the TV while I'm on my elliptical machine. And I get into the motion of the skiers. I'm not thinking about it. I'm not thinking, okay, I need to do 30 minutes on the elliptical. I put on a race and then I get into it. My body wants to go with the people on the TV. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, that was an hour and a half. I guess I'm done.
Well, what I would like to do is get back to this topic a little bit, but maybe we can start out. I'd like to, traditionally, I sort of ask people, obviously you're on a vegan diet now and an athlete and all this, but was that part of your upbringing? Was that, did you grow up conventionally or how did that all look?
I grew up in a hunting state where I still live. So one of the rites of passage for a boy growing up here is to kill a deer, or some, you know, kill moose and bear as well. But that was the thing that you had to do. You had to go out and hunt and prove your manhood and get the deer and then strap it to the hood of your car and drive around town with it so everybody could see that you're a man. That's the culture I was raised in. So, you know, a lot has changed since then, but I never wanted to kill things. It just didn't feel right, but I ate meat and I ate a lot of it and I drank a ton of dairy. We lived across the street from a dairy farm. And so we'd get fresh milk and I would drink probably a gallon a day. So, you know, it was a pretty clean diet. My parents were somewhat hippies. They moved to Vermont to escape New York City to have an organic farm and be hippies. But there was a lot of meat. We had our own chickens that we killed, and a lot of meat from the, you know, farmers across the street. And so it was pretty clean, but it was far from vegan.
So your parents were actually from New York?
Yeah.
Did they have like kind of corporate jobs before that or?
My mom worked on Wall Street and my dad had just passed all the exams to be a New York City cop. And at the last minute they decided not to do that, that they didn't want to raise kids in that. So they escaped north to be hippies. It was the late 60s.
Right, okay. Excellent. And I believe part of it is a blueberry farm, or is it entirely a blueberry farm, or what is the state of it now?
Yeah, so we had 400 high bush blueberry trees, I call them, because they're over 2 meters tall. Now we have about 300 left. So disease and bears and other things have killed about 100 of them, but we get about 15 liters per bush per year. So it's a pretty substantial amount of blueberries. But now it's more of a hobby. I'm the blueberry farmer. Everybody else has kind of just decided they no longer want to be a part of it. So it's something I do in the summers. I take care of the blueberry orchard.
Oh, well. And where does that go? Is it sold to a distributor or a farmer's market, or how does that?
Sometimes farmer's markets, sometimes local stores, sometimes a farm stand. Mm-hmm. It's had various iterations and, you know, I'm so busy doing other things that I can't dedicate myself to that full time. So we only pick maybe 15% of the crop. The rest goes to the birds and the bears.
Oh, no way. Wow.
Yeah. Just, you know, I've always wanted to have the Woodstock Fruit Festival come to the farm and just pick berries for a couple days. Like, hey, you know, let's bring a bus. I'm an hour and a half away from the festival.
Oh my God. I can't believe you've not done that.
And you can, well, it's, you know, there's liability issues and.
Right.
And whatnot, but I brought Tony Wright there a few times to pick.
That's amazing. That's brilliant. And are these like blueberries that no one's ever tasted? Like, are they like way beyond what's in the shops and stuff? Or
so, I'm sure this is the same with any kind of fruit that you buy in a store, not a farmer's stand, but a store versus straight off the bush. You've never had a blueberry unless you've eaten it straight from the bush.
Right.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the things that people don't consider is that blueberries ripen in the summer. It's generally pretty hot. So a blueberry is warm to hot when you eat it.
Oh, wow.
But you're never going to eat a hot or warm blueberry in the store. In fact, if you bought hot or warm blueberries, you'd think that was repulsive. But when you eat them off the bush, the flavor, because they're probably 35 degrees Celsius, you know, straight on the bush. They're just baking in the sun. And it's a, and they just, the flavor is, the whole experience is so dramatically different than eating a blueberry in the store. There's no comparison.
Wow, I never thought about that. And what was your health like growing up? And obviously, it sounds like you weren't ethically in line with, you know, killing animals and eating meat. But did it have an impact? Did your diet growing up have an impact on your health? And was blueberries a big part of your diet growing up?
No, I was never really much of a fruit eater. Mm-hmm. We also had strawberries, and I learned to hate strawberries just because that's a hands and knees on the ground kind of job. And as a kid, weeding strawberry plants just made me hate the fruit. So no, my diet was pretty bad. I hated vegetables. I wouldn't eat anything green. It was pretty much whatever version of junk food I could get, which wasn't really super junk because my parents were, you know, organic hippies. And then when I went off on my own, went to college and beyond, I became a fast food eater. Mm-hmm. I pretty much lived on fast food. And that didn't change until I was 30 when I switched to a vegan diet. And my vegan diet was pretty crappy as well until 2004 when I became raw. So the majority of my life, I, you know, had a horrible diet.
Did you notice any impact on your health as a result of that?
Well, one of my keys to success, and that I don't mean that on a grand scale, I just mean personally, I take things on as experiments, because if I take it on as a commitment, I know that I'll fail. And I don't want to set myself up for depression or disappointment, because I have a tendency towards depression. And when I make a commitment and then witness myself default on that commitment, that can lead to depression, because it's like, well, you just, you know, you can't do anything. So every change I've ever made in my life, I've languaged it to myself as an experiment. So when I switched to a vegan diet, it was only at the insistence of my girlfriend at the time. I had just moved in with her, and she said, no animal products in this house. And I was like, what? So she gave me a long list of things that would occur if I went vegan. One would be that I wouldn't lose my hair, my skin would stay younger, longer. You know, it's the fountain of youth, she said. And I thought, okay, I'm an actor. It'd be nice if I looked younger for longer. I'll try it as an experiment. I'm not committing to this. But within a week or two, my sleep improved so dramatically that I stayed with the diet, because I had been an insomniac for the vast majority of my life. And suddenly I was sleeping. And that was so new to me and so needed that it's like, well, why wouldn't I remain vegan? That right there is worth the price of admission. It wasn't about animals and it wasn't about the environment. Initially, it was vanity, but vanity was quickly replaced by, I'm sleeping and I'd like to remain sleeping at night.
Wow.
And then, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to go back. Was acting, was that the main thing for you in the early part of your life?
Well, it's fascinating, again, who I am now as we have this conversation and who I have been historically are so alien to each other that anybody that has known me for the past 30 or 40 years, they're like, shaking their head like, I can't believe you became this guy, you know, because I know who you were and I don't know how you became the guy that you are now. It doesn't make sense. I became an actor because I would fall down on anything I ever tried to do. I just couldn't do anything consistently for long. I would fall into a depression. I have a very, very fragile ego or identity, and it just goes into trauma mode at the snap of a finger. And so whenever I tried to do anything, I would fall apart pretty quickly. And I thought, well, I need a job where you only work a couple months a year, and then you get to maybe take a couple years off, and then you work a few months and take a couple years off. And what kind of job? Acting. Yeah, that's what it's like to be an actor. I thought that was the only thing I could do, honestly. I thought, well, I either try to make it as an actor or I commit suicide because I don't see another option.
That was when you're in your teens that you were thinking that.
No, I was terrified of being an actor in my teens. I didn't start acting until I was in college. At the encouragement, I was a skier, Nordic, a cross-country skier, and I had a mentor. She told me to take dance class. She said it'll be great for your balance, great for your kinesthetic awareness. And I was embarrassed as hell to take dance class. But I did, and it opened something up in me. And then I thought, well, what about acting class? Like there was an expression that wanted to come out. But I was so painfully shy and insecure that I thought, well, there's no way that I could be an actor, but maybe I can learn how to pretend not to be shy anymore. Maybe I can create a persona that I can go out into the world with, and I won't appear as fragile as I know myself to be. So I took acting classes to try to build that false exterior. And what happened instead was that I learned how to actually get in touch with something beneath that fragile identity and found a really grounded place that became more and more defined the more I was on stage, but only when I was on stage. I couldn't take that out into the world. So I thought, well, maybe I have this talent for acting, so let's see if I can make a career out of it because I can't do anything else.
I'm quite fascinated by acting as a practice, and I've done a little bit of drama in school and that kind of thing, like a lot of people have. And there's something unusual about the idea of embodying emotions that you're not, that aren't real, or creating a real emotion out of an unreal situation that you're going through, and creating a character and all. And as you were saying, like, I think the thing you said about there about creating a persona, and a lot of people, I think that that's part of what everyone sort of does to get through life to some degree, is they have a persona, and many people sort of their persona maybe is who they are, or it takes over or whatever. I don't know exactly all about this, but this idea of acting is like continually creating these different, and I guess bringing out different parts. It's no, people just talk about it as an art form, I guess, but it seems almost like it could really open up something in people. And it seems to be you're suggesting something like that.
Yeah, I don't see it as an art form, and I should be clear that film acting and stage acting are two dramatically different experiences. Stage acting, there is an arc, and you're moving through this arc in real time with an audience present. Whereas film acting is so disintegrated, meaning that I can be in this moment now, totally unrelated to anything that happened a moment ago. They set the cameras up and they're doing a close-up on me to get a particular emotion, to get a particular response, but it's not a response to something that actually just happened. I have to make that all up in my head. I have to imagine or pretend or embody that something just happened. Whereas on the stage, that's not the case. So I don't recommend film acting because it is a disintegrated experience. And they even film things out of sequence. But stage acting, you're very much in real time, not pretending. See, this is the mistake I think most people make when they act. You're not pretending to have these emotions. You're having these emotions. And it's you that you're portraying. You're just speaking somebody else's words, inhabiting somebody else's situation. If I were in this situation saying these words, what would that feel like? But they're your feelings.
Yeah.
And it's really about taking ownership and using yourself as the canvas. Like, I am the canvas. And when I say these words, I'm going to really put myself into that situation. And I'm going to discover for myself in front of an audience what that's like to be in that situation and communicating this with someone else. I don't know what that's like yet. Let me find out, honestly. And I'm safe because it's scripted. I don't have to worry about the unknown. And that's, for me as a shy person, this is one of the biggest breakthroughs in my life when I discovered acting, because nobody was going to hurt me. I could really embody this experience, and I could really embody the words that I was communicating, and there was no consequence. Whereas if I do that in the real world, if I just walk up to you and I risk communication, there could be consequences. Mm-hmm. But I was protected by the script, by the scene that was taking place, by the story. So it allowed me to be a much greater expression of my instrument, let's say. So I think acting is one of the most profound experiences that someone can have if they really allow themselves to have it rather than pretending to be someone else. You're not pretending to be anyone else. You're just being yourself in a situation that's novel for you.
That's fascinating. And, you know, I'm a little bit aware of, I've had a few conversations with you about your, some of this, I guess some of the successes that you had as an actor, and that you did work as an actor, and maybe people, some people even that follow you don't realize that. And how did that all take place, and what could you tell us a little bit about your story as an actor?
Yeah, again, it's a tragic story, because it's a tragic profession for the most part,
right.
Regardless of what you know, the image that people have of Hollywood and celebrity. It's, there's so much fragility and so much just negativity. So I started as a stage actor, again, because it was this profound opening for me. It was the only time that I could be honest in front of people is when I was on stage speaking somebody else's words. Now, I wasn't communicating with my own words, but I was communicating honestly with my feelings, and I had never done that before. I had always hidden. I had always pretended.
Wow.
So for me, pretense was my default state. Acting was the only time I stepped out of pretense. So that was so such a shock to me when I discovered that that was available. So I did a lot of stage. I went to Washington, D.C. after college and did some theater there. And I got noticed by some people from Los Angeles. They wanted me to come out and do some industrial films. But I got scared and decided not to go. So then years later, I decided to go to Los Angeles, bought a motorcycle, and I had never ridden one before, and decided I was going to motorcycle across the country from Vermont to California. It's like 3,000 miles. And if I didn't die on the trip, because I had no experience on a motorcycle, if I didn't die, then I would stay in Los Angeles, and I would stay there for a year because I imagined it would be a horrible place to live. But the motorcycle trip turned out to be a tragedy. So I ended up coming back to Vermont. And then a few years later, I bought another motorcycle and tried again. I don't know why the motorcycle theme, but it just felt like the badass thing to do. I was trying to kill a part of me. You know, I was trying to just wear away this thing that I was disgusted by, that that I had been pretending to be my whole life until that point. So I finally made it out there for real in 97 and worked in casting as well as working at restaurants. And I learned more about acting, working in casting, like casting who's going to be in the film and TV show. That was the greatest acting experience I ever had. But then I booked a bunch of commercials, did some TV films, did a lot of voiceover for radio and for commercials where you don't see the person, you just hear their voice. And, you know, it wasn't a huge success, but my commercials did quite well. I had, you know, some gigantic national commercials that played for years. And that's nice to get those paychecks rolling in. But,
oh, is that what happens? You continue to get paid for it.
Oh, you get royalties, yeah.
Wow.
So the more they play it, the more you get paid. I had one commercial that played during the NBA playoffs, during the World Series. Didn't play during the Super Bowl. That would have been nice. But
did you ever get people recognize you from that?
Yeah, oh, quite often, yeah.
Quite a lot?
Yeah.
Wow.
Much more from YouTube. That's the funny thing. I get, you know, I can go anywhere and it's likely that somebody will recognize me from YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. And that's always surprises me because my audience is not that large. But there are a lot of people tuning in and, it's a little bit disconcerting that I'm known by people around the world from a YouTube channel, much more so than my acting career.
So you were you acting when you went vegan and met this girlfriend and stuff?
Yeah, that was the kind of the beginning. I was in LA for about a year when she and I got together and I decided to be vegan. But, the acting thing is a rough business and there are a lot of predators and I fell victim to some people that had bad intentions. And it was a pretty tragic story, but that's fine because it opened up other doors for me and I chose different pathways and I'm here now and I like where I am.
You always hear a lot of things about Hollywood, about like the negative side of that, and obviously there's a lot of people that go and try and make it and must be like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people or whatever, huge number of people that don't get anywhere or whatever
that are really good. They're very talented people, right? And nobody knows that they exist.
But as you're saying, like, there's, you know, there's this other side, this idea of like people being taken advantage of and strange things going on, and obviously there was like Harvey Weinstein and all that stuff came out. So there's a lot of shadiness that seems to be connected with it all. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna say that that's the norm, but it exists. And you know, it's like there are some neighborhoods that have a high rate of violence. It doesn't mean that if you go into that neighborhood, you're going to be a victim of violence, but the likelihood increases. And the Me Too movement opened people's eyes probably more than they had been opened before to the casting couch in Hollywood. But other than Kevin Spacey, I don't think it was made all that clear how much this affects men as well as women.
Wow.
And that story never really got told. I'm straight, but there are a lot of predatory men in Hollywood who are not straight. And this is not a comment on someone's sexuality. It's just that people put themselves into positions of power so that they can prey on people that are willing to do whatever it takes to get a role. And you'll be put into situations where they're like, do you want this? And it's like, yeah, well, how bad do you want it? Really? Will you do anything? Yeah, I'll do anything to get it. Oh, will you? Well, let's see if you'll do anything to get it. You know,
as blatant as that. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it's an art form. be a predator. You know, it's, and you never know what you're getting into. You know, you're innocent and you think, wow, this person likes me and they've got my best interest and I'm going to be a star and they're promising me all this stuff. And they lead you down the, is it the primrose path? Is that the...
The primrose path. It's funny. I have a friend that referenced that, but he was in the army. It was like some kid. He used it in some. I don't know. I think he called. Funnily enough, I think he had a tattoo studio that he called the Primrose Path or something. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know exactly what it is, but yeah. So it is interesting because with you talking about your fragility, it almost seems like that would be almost like not the right profession to have chosen, because it seems to me there's a lot of rejection in acting. Like, you go to a lot of auditions, and that's to me, like, not getting a job is one thing, but not getting an audition is like when you're talking about the experience you've been through, where you're, when acting is like you've been, you know, bringing out this, you know, the truth of this honest part of yourself, yeah, and exposing that. Yeah. And then not being picked, it's like, wow, that's like really crushing on a different level. And then obviously being so open in front of all these audiences, it's curious, it's interesting that although you say it was a profession you picked because it would fit in with you, it's also, I guess it must have been quite challenging as well for you.
Yeah, and well, again, I can say that it's tragic if I tell the story one particular way from the perspective of my identity. But if I step outside of that perspective and I look at the tools that were made available to me from having those experiences, then I can see that I've modeled that same experience again and again and again in different ways ever since. So if I'm being vulnerable in a purely honest, emotive state in front of someone, and they reject me, okay, if I'm doing that as an identity, that could be terminal. That could be a permanent mark on my sense of self or my self-esteem. Like, you are being rejected. You brought yourself forth fully, honestly, vulnerably, and they're like, next. Like, sorry. We don't value who you are. And the one thing you have to realize that identity almost never realizes, you are not right for this role in this moment.
Yeah.
And it's not that you are bad. It's just that you are not right for this role. And quick story, on my resume, I had knife throwing. Because you want to put all kinds of stuff on your resume to make you look interesting and to start conversations, mostly. Like, you know, it'd be, oh, look at that, knife throwing. And then they bring you in just to have a conversation about it, you know. So my agent calls me up and says, hey, I've got an audition for you. And it had been a while for a big national commercial. And they need a knife thrower. And it's like, I'm not really a knife thrower. Yeah. I grew up throwing butter knives at squash on the farm with my dad. You know, my dad taught me how to throw butter knives.
I've actually seen a clip of you doing that.
Yes. And the first year of the Woodstock Fruit Festival, we took the watermelon rinds that were empty and we lined them up and had knife throwing until the camp said, uh-uh, no, no more. But I had a knife throwing class year one of the Woodstock Fruit Festival.
Yeah, a nice safe class for everyone, knife throwing.
People loved it. Oh my God, they were having so much fun. It was great. I'm sure it was a liability disaster, but they're butter knives.
It's in the film from the first year. Like, one of the highlights from the first year's Woodstock is a clip of you, like, jumping in there, twisting and throwing a knife into a watermelon.
Oh, I got to see that. That's funny.
Yeah, I was always curious about that. That's so funny that came up. I was like, how did that happen that Tim's randomly throwing a knife into it?
Yeah, because I grew up on a farm and I played with knives. So back to this story, the agent's like, all right, they need a knife thrower. And it's like, I'm not a professional. I'm a guy that literally throws butter knives. She's like, go, just go anyway. It doesn't matter. So I get to the audition and there's all these circus performer looking people with the typical knife thrower's outfit. And they've got these rolled up leather, I don't know what you'd call them, knife holders that they, you know, they undo the leather strap and they roll them out and they've got all their professional knives in there and they're sharpening knives. And the waiting room is full of these guys and they all know each other because it's the knife throwing community. And so, you know, so-and-so, he's like, so how'd you do in Vegas? Oh, it was great. You know, And, oh, hey, weren't you just at the World Championships? He's like, yeah, well, how'd you do? Yeah, I won. So literally, no exaggeration, the world champion knife thrower is sitting next to me. Wow. And I don't have any knives with me because I don't have a leather thing with butter knives shoved in it. I had nothing. So anyway, we're sitting in the waiting room and we keep hearing thud, ding, because the knives are not sticking and they're hitting the floor. So when you hear these big, heavy throwing knives hitting the concrete or tile floor, it's making an awful racket. So person after person, you hear the knife hit the target and then you hear it drop onto the floor. And everybody's getting really nervous because we haven't heard a single knife stick yet. So people are starting to freak out and, you know, they guys are coming out and they're like, what's happening? They're like, you can't stick them. It's plywood. These knives don't stick in plywood. They're like, oh shit. But they're like, don't worry about it. They're really just looking for the type. So finally they call me in and they're like, where are your knives? Oh, I didn't know I was supposed to bring knives. It's a knife throwing audition. I'm like, do you have a kitchen? What do you mean? Do you have a kitchen? Yes, we have a kitchen. Well, hold on. I'll be right back. Where are you going? I'm going to the kitchen. I'm going to see if you have any butter knives. What? You're going to throw butter knives? Anyway, this woman led me into the kitchen. I found a couple butter knives. They just had lunch. They were in the sink. They were dirty. And they're different sizes and lengths. So I pull out like three or four random butter knives that don't match. I wipe them off. I bring them back in. And there's a woman dressed totally in black, very New York City look. She's on the phone. And she puts the phone down and she says, seriously? Just don't waste our time. Just please call the next person in. I'm like, no. I can throw these. She's like, no, you can't. I'm like, yes, I can. So the other people looking at me, they're like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah. And I take a knife and they're like, wait a minute, stop. What? Aren't you going to measure your steps? No. Well, all the other guys measured their steps. They paced out an exact distance from the target. They're like, you're not going to do that? No, I eye it. I throw it by eye. That's how I learned how to do it. So they're like, okay. So the woman gets back on the phone. She's talking again, completely ignoring me. So I take the first knife, feeling the weight because I've never held this knife before. And you feel it. It talks to your hand. And whoosh, thump, and it's stuck in the wood.
Oh, wow.
And it stayed because it's a butter knife. It's not thick. It's not a throwing knife. They're very thick and heavy. Butter knives have a very thin blade. They don't weigh much. So it hit the target and it stuck. And they started screaming. And The woman put the phone down. She looked over and she's like, hold on, I got to call you back. This guy just stuck a butter knife. So they're like, do it again. And like the festival, I said, do you want me to do a trick? They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I can jump up in the air and do a 360 and throw it. They're like, no, you can't. So I jumped, did a spin, threw the knife, stuck it. And they were jumping and applauding and going nuts. And I threw another one. It stuck. And this is not boasting. Butter knives are pretty easy to throw if you have a little bit of practice. Nothing extraordinary about it. And of course, they're going to stick better in plywood than a throwing knife is. After a couple minutes, they asked me some questions and the producer took me aside and said, thank you so much. You made our day. That is the most fun that we have had all week. You're totally wrong for the role. You don't look the part at all. But man, thank you so much for just making our day. And I walked out. And all the guys in the room are looking at me like, who the hell is this guy? Why were they cheering for him? How come we didn't hear any knives falling on the floor? And they were like, they're all whispering and talking. I'm like, oh my God, who's that? And I walked out with a puffed chest. Anyway, the point is this. In that moment, there was a realization that stuck with me forever after, that you can do your best. You can knock it out of the park and still be wrong for the role.
Yeah.
And that if you can recognize that, and that you don't need someone else's validation to tell you that, because you're not always going to get people applauding you and jumping up and down and cheering. Sometimes they may think to themselves, wow, I really loved that, but they're just wrong for the role. But they don't tell you that. They just say, next.
Yeah.
So that was a huge moment for me in recognizing that it's okay to be wrong for the role, that there is a me that will be right for some role, but it's not someone else that determines what that is. Ultimately, if I keep putting myself in somebody else's hands and say, please, please make sure, you know, look at me, maybe I'm right for the role. But what if I just put myself out there on my own? What if I just start communicating without someone's permission? What if I put myself into the position of running raw? I'm going to start a YouTube channel and a website. Nobody asked me to do that.
Yeah.
Nobody said, hey, we're selecting you to be the guy that does this. So I don't have to be right for that role. In fact, I was wrong for that role. I was terrible for the role of running raw. But thank God I did it, because it was such an incredible educational experience that I've become a guy that I never, ever imagined I would become. I don't, you know, this guy is completely unrecognizable to me even 15 years ago. So, you know, it all comes back to now stepping outside of the need for your identity to be validated by other people, and even by yourself, and just moving into the things that really empower you, and practicing the things that you love to do, and also putting it out there for someone to notice if they so choose. Like, if somebody doesn't watch my YouTube videos, do I take offense to that? No. Because I like making them. If nobody listens, that's okay, because I got to listen to it. That doesn't mean that I love to hear myself talk. It simply means that it gave me an opportunity to really think deeply about a particular topic, to spend some time figuring out, well, how do I feel about this? How would I do that? And then I record it, and then I edit it to make sure, yeah, okay, yeah, that is how I would do it. Okay, that wasn't really clear before, but now it's clear. And then I share it, because it made a difference to me first. And nobody has to approve. Nobody has to watch it. Doesn't matter, because I keep getting smarter. Every video I make helps to make me more educated, even if nobody ever watches it. Okay, I'm done with the rant.
Love that story. That story was amazing. But so let me bring myself into the story a little bit, because
please do.
My friend shared a video in Earthlings, and I watched it. And there's a whole story leading up to that, me being ready to watch that and everything.
Yeah.
But I watched that, and I was like, okay, I think I'm going to go vegan. Because I just thought, I don't need to be part of that. I'm not really eating animal products that much anymore anyway. And then it was like, okay, I didn't know anything about it, health benefits. I didn't realize there was any benefit to it. I kind of thought there might be a bad side to it. So I was looking up, you know, the same questions everyone looks up. Where do you get your protein and all that yeah. stuff? And I come across the video, The Protein Myth. And I kind of had the conspiracy theory. I was like a conspiracy theory fan before that. So the idea of a video called The Protein Myth was like, yeah. kind of like attractive to me, you know, from that, oh, there's maybe another side to this, you know. And it was your video. And I think it's maybe only a 5 minute video, 5, 6, 7 minute video. But that really switched the light on for me, because out of the blue, it wasn't just a vegan video or a protein video, it was you talking about raw foods as well. And in that particular, at that time, and in that video, you were saying, like, you know, people ask me if I could, if I, where do I get my protein, and is it from nuts and sprouts and blah, 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 and supplements. And at that time, you're saying, I don't eat any of that. I eat fruits and vegetables. And you talked about the amino acids, and you talked about how if you weren't getting enough protein, how come you had more muscle than you should have, and you were out competing people half your age. And that just had such an impact on me, and it really answered a lot of questions. It was the first time that I thought, is the idea of living on fruits and vegetables, or primarily that or whatever, is not that strange a thing to have thought or to have wondered about. But you always assume, like, you couldn't really do that, no one can do that. But for someone to say it and put it forward as an idea and say, it just makes you think, and it makes you go, well, wait a minute. You know, he's talking about being stronger, actually. He's not talking about being weaker, he's talking about being fitter. And then you start to go, well, chimpanzees, gorillas, like, they're all stronger, like, and it just all of these things kind of fell into place. And that was my first little opening into the whole concept of raw foods, and even the whole concept that a vegan diet could be a healthy, beneficial thing. And so your impact's obviously had an impact on me, and that's led to other things that I've done as well over the years. And part of going to Woodstock was to meet you as well and learn more from you and hear the, what you had to say. So what led up to that point in your life where you were out giving speeches in front of audiences and things like that? How did all that develop?
Yeah, it's never something that I planned on doing. It was never a career path. There was a group in Chicago. They called themselves Run Raw. And they wanted to run the Chicago Marathon. There was a group of maybe five or six of them. And they wanted to do the Chicago Marathon, 2006, I think, and do it raw. And they had never heard of anybody running a marathon as a raw foodist and being maintained at the aid stations with raw foods, coconut water, etc., dates. So they found me on YouTube. They're like, hey, look at this. There's a guy who's a raw runner out in Los Angeles. They reached out to me and they're like, could we pay you to come to Chicago and train our group for a week or two for the Chicago Marathon and help provide support during the race? Help, you know, okay, what should they eat prior to the race, the night before the race, during the race? Like, could you help organize all that? And I'm like, well, yeah, that'd be fun. So I went to Chicago. I met with them. They were amazing. The marathon was incredible. Many of these people are, you know, still my friends now. And the woman that organized it all, she was also the head of the Chicago Raw community. And she said, you know, if you stick around a little longer, we're going to be having a raw vegan Thanksgiving, and I would love for you to talk at this event. And I was like, oh, wow, that, you know, how many people are going to be there? And it'll probably be a couple hundred. Okay.
Wow.
And I was really scared because she's like, just share your story. Just talk about what, you know, you do and how you came to be this and what the performance and results are like. And I did. And the audience was incredibly receptive. And then another woman there said, you know what, who was also part of this Run Raw team. She said, I think we should take this on the road, and I think we should speak to running clubs all over the Midwest. So I decided to stay longer, and we drove around the Midwest from Chicago to Minneapolis to Milwaukee to Kansas City to St. Louis, and we would reach out to running groups and say, hey, or raw food communities, you know, meetup groups, and would you like to hear this raw runner give a presentation on what he's experiencing on a raw vegan diet as an athlete in his 40s? And, you know, there were yeses across the board. So before I know it, I had given like 10 or 12 talks. And then I had to go back to LA and go back to work. But this group in Chicago was like, all right, let's plan the next round. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, you have to keep doing this. People love your message. And then they reached out, you know, I'm an introvert. I'm incredibly shy. So they were hugely supportive of me. They reached out to some people in Los Angeles and said, hey, we think that you should have Tim speak at these groups in LA. So then I started speaking in Los Angeles. I met up with David Wolf and did some talks with him in the San Diego area. Did some talks in San Francisco. Started, you know, becoming a fixture in the California raw food scene on the speaking circuit. And then I thought, okay, let's really ramp this up. There are a lot of national championship races that I'd like to do around the country, and I can't afford to do them. It's a lot of travel, and there's a lot of stair climb races I'd like to do all over the country, but I can't afford to do them. So I'm going to reach out to a raw food group or a running club in each one of these cities, and if I can book a talk and get paid to give it, I will go do the race, and the talk will pay for the travel. And that became kind of the engine for this. It fueled my races. And it allowed me to not go into massive debt to keep this thing alive. And then it just all kind of spiraled from there. And here we are.
Wow.
But it was a hustle. You know, it was.
Yeah.
It was a hustle.
That's pretty amazing. And I actually think I might have been to that Chicago raw food group.
Yeah.
I was in Chicago once.
Oh, they're amazing.
Mike last one time in Chicago, and he took me to a group.
Yeah,
there was a meetup.
Yeah, they're an amazing group of people.
But getting back, what was your journey from vegan to raw foods?
So I primarily ate a vegan junk food diet. In Los Angeles, there were lots of vegan bakeries and vegan pizza and burrito places, and you could get vegan chili cheese fries at, you know, several different joints. Like, it was vegan central out there. So my diet sucked. And I was working at a vegan restaurant, and I would take care of raw foodists coming in. Now, once every couple of weeks, a raw foodist would come in. Lou Corona. I don't know if you know Lou.
Yeah,
he was coming in all the time. He would get a gigantic salad with avocado, and then he'd give me a lecture about the benefits of raw food and tell me about all the different ingredients in the salad and what they did. And so he kind of felt the need to mentor me.
Show you his plank and stuff and some of his physical.
No, he never did any planks at the restaurant. But the man's got a serious core, I'll tell you that. And then there were other people too. Justin Bua, who's a graffiti artist, he would bring in cacao beans, and he'd give me these raw cacao beans and tell me about the benefits and raw food. And then there was this other couple, they were billionaires. They would come in and talk to me about it. And so over the years, I got to know these people pretty well, but I never wanted to eat a raw diet. It sounded insane to me. But then my health started to fail. And depression came on pretty strong, chronic fatigue came on pretty strong, and it got to the point where my boss brought me in and said, you know, I got to let you go. When you're here, you're not here. You're like a ghost walking around. And I said, I know, I'm sorry. I'm falling apart physically. I don't know what to do.
Wow.
So word got out at the restaurant. It's a vegan restaurant, so it's a small community, even in Los Angeles. Everybody knows everybody. So a lot of these people were really concerned for me because I gave, you know, a couple of weeks' notice, and several of them said, hey, you got to switch to a raw diet. And I'm like, yeah, it's not going to happen. And finally, this billionaire couple, they're like, here's the deal. We like you, and we're willing to invest in you. So we're going to take you to every raw restaurant in Southern California, and we're going to get everything on the menu, and we're going to pay for it, and you're going to try it, and we're going to find a way for you to be a raw foodist. You're going to have so many different things to try that there's no way you're going to reject all of them. And then we'll figure out the things that you do like eating, and then That'll be the foundation of your diet.
Wow.
So they did that. They, for maybe a week or a week and a half, they just took me from restaurant to restaurant. And I was like, okay, this doesn't
That's
suck.
Incredible.
Yeah, there's some really extraordinary things that I can eat. And I enjoyed it. And I said, all right, I'm going to try this for a week as an experiment. And at the end of the week, I started feeling normal again. And that was surprising to me because it happened so quickly. And then I thought, I'll do it for another week. I never planned on doing it for more than just a blip because I didn't think it would work and I thought it would be awful. But at the end of that second week, the transformation was so profound that I thought, I gotta do this. If I want to live, I have to do this. Because I was imagining myself being homeless. I thought, you know, I can't work. What am I going to do? I'm too shy to ask for help. I'm going to end up homeless.
Wow.
And eating a raw diet just turned all of that upside down. And after a year, I got my job back at the restaurant. And I became a photographer. I had been a photographer, but just as a hobbyist. And I started doing it professionally, taking actors' headshots, and that allowed me to not be at the restaurant full time because it was too stressful. And then after a year, my whole body had transformed. I looked like I was 18 again. I just had so much energy, and I was sick and tired of people like David Wolf saying that you're going to have more energy on a raw diet. Everybody says it, but I was experiencing it. And nobody wanted to hear me say it. Prove it. Show me. Like, talk is cheap. You're all bragging that you have more energy on this diet. Show me. So I was a runner in high school and 1 or 2 years in college. And I thought, well, what's a better metric for human energy and endurance than running? It's pretty much a level playing field. It's not about the equipment like cycling. So I started running just to see if I actually had this energy or if I was just fantasizing, and, pretty quickly discovered that it was yielding real world, energetic results. And I started the Running Raw Project shortly thereafter with the goal to make a U.S. Olympic trials and win some national championships and just to demonstrate that a raw food diet was pretty extraordinary. And if I could do that, I thought maybe I can get other big athletes to switch. And if they switch, maybe they'll impact kids who look up to them. And maybe this is a way to change the diet of the youth in America. Wow. By getting other, I never expected to be the guy on stage. I thought if I can demonstrate this through some pretty big results and make a documentary about it, which became a YouTube channel, then other people will change their diets. Maybe Michael Jordan will decide he wants to start playing basketball again as a raw vegan. Or at the time, you know, these were the people that were, Andre Agassi had just retired from tennis. Maybe Andre will pick up a racket again as a raw vegan because Martina Navratilova had done that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So maybe I can get the people that do have a platform, maybe I can get them to make a change. So that was the goal. It was never supposed to be about me.
Wow. And I mean, that's such a cool story of how that happened. And the Running Raw Project was an incredibly ambitious goal. But that's like a great thing. Like, and I suppose it's interesting, like, the first thing I want to ask about what you're kind of talking about there is that at that time, it feels like there was a raw food movement in LA and California that was quite active. And you're talking about a bunch of different raw foodists coming into your restaurant and talking about it and people being excited about it. Could you give a picture of what was going on then? Was there a community there in LA? Was there talks? Was there a scene?
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think every generation has a moment where something is coming together in the perfect mixture with the perfect people at the perfect time. And it just kind of explodes onto the scene. And that, I was just in the right place at the right time with the right people. And David Wolf was doing quite well with Nature's First Law, which turns out that he basically plagiarized another book. But that's a different story. then he also had the Some Food Diet Success System. Paul Neeson had come out with his books. Gabriel Cousins, Matt Monarch had written a book. Brian Clement, like it was, everybody was just coming out with their stuff. And it seemed like it was all happening around the same time. Giuliano, who was my neighbor in Los Angeles, had opened a restaurant in San Francisco called Raw. And then he opened one in Southern California too, in Santa Monica.
Wow, he was your neighbor?
He was my neighbor. Yeah, literally my next door neighbor.
Just coincidentally?
Just coincidentally. I used to watch him. There was a parking lot between our houses, and I used to look out my window and I'd see him twirling in a dress. He'd be out there twirling around, listening to music in a dress. And I was just fascinated by watching him twirl. And Rainbow Mars, who is, I forget if she was his, no, she, yeah, it doesn't matter. She was part of that scene as well. She was over there a lot. And David and Lou Corona, Matt Monarch, I used to go to his house. We would have Raw parties. John Rulak, who was the CEO of Nutiva, he was part of that scene. So he was my sponsor for a while. Rory Friedman was one of my best friends. She wrote the book Skinny Bitch and then seven other books about veganism. And we would have, she would have these big vegan potlucks where, Sean Munson, who made Earthlings, you know, like everybody, they would, like, wow. The potlucks at Rory's house were huge. Everybody who's everybody in the vegan world was there. And I would bring Raw stuff. So, like, I was introducing all these vegan celebrities to Raw foods. Alicia Silverstone, you name it. Like, it was just, it was all happening in this one bubble, this kind of inclusive bubble. And everybody kind of was blowing up at the same time. Brendan Brazier was a good friend of mine. Brendan founded Vega, the sports. Like he would, you know, he was at my house all the time. We would have these potlucks. I would make everybody raw vegan ice cream out of coconut milk. Like it was just a, like it couldn't happen now. You know, it couldn't happen here. It was just the perfect collision of all these people and raw foodism not being seen as an ideology yet or not being tainted by particular personalities on YouTube. Like it was innocent and it was raw and it was emerging, you know, as like, hey, this could be the next new thing. And there were all these voices popping up and I reached out to Doug Graham at one point and said, hey, you know, I'm trying to be an athlete and you seem to be the only person writing a raw food book that knows anything about athletics. Like I've asked everybody else and they don't know what to do. They're like, yeah, that's not our, not our thing. So I asked Doug to train me and give me a diet. And I didn't follow it because it was just too expensive. Like the diet he wrote up for me, it's like, Doug, that's like $150 a week in fruit. I can't afford that. And his comment may have been something like, well, you know, how much is your health worth? You know, how much is your success worth? If you want it, that's how much it costs. You just got to figure out how to make the money. Just go make the money and then do it. And I'm like, oh, you know. But it was amazing, you know, the collision of all that stuff and where we all are now, you know, all the different things that have come out of that and the people and the events, Woodstock and UK Fruit Fest and all the YouTube dramas and controversies and some people disappearing and new people emerging and it's.
There's what there is, the interesting thing about what you're saying to me is it was what you were experiencing at that time was there was still, maybe the word is also like a complete mystery around it.
Yeah, it was innocent. Yeah.
The potential of that.
Yeah.
In terms of, because no one, not many people had ever done it or ever seen it. So could an athlete go to the Olympics in their 40s? Like, who knew?
Yeah.
No one really knew if that would be possible or not. Maybe it is that life-changing. Is it the secret to enlightenment? Is it the thing that makes people take 20 years off? Like, I think now there's more people that have done those experiments and we've got more awareness of what the benefits are and what the limitations are and stuff. But I can imagine at that time there was a sense of, like, there was still a great, it was unexposed, it was unexperimented, but was that maybe part of the feeling as well?
Well, absolutely. It was like you were getting, well, at least me being in, I lived in Venice Beach in Los Angeles. So I wasn't just in Los Angeles, but I was in the epicenter of the raw food movement. And there was no YouTube. There was no Facebook. There was no access to what we have access to now. So it was like, it exists here. It's this, it's the people and the culture, and nobody else knows about it unless they've read one of these obscure books that one of these people has written. And these are not the kind of books you find in the bookstore. They're the kind of books that somebody gives you. Like, somebody gave me a copy of Nature's First Law at the restaurant. You know, I didn't go to the bookstore and seek it out. There was no raw food section or even vegan section at that point. So if you weren't part of one of those insular hubs, like LA, like Chicago, a little bit in New York City, a little tiny bit in San Francisco. If you weren't a part of that, then you were completely left in the dark, which is one of the reasons I wanted to go around the country spreading the message. Because where would you find this information otherwise?
The interesting thing is to me, you're talking about, there was no Facebook, there was none of the social media, right? However, you're also talking about there being raw food communities and groups and restaurants and like hundreds of people being at these things. I think you would struggle today to find many groups of hundreds of raw foodists getting together at potlucks and stuff like that. There's more people online, there's more awareness of it, there's more something out there, but they were still getting people together back then, whatever way that was getting out there, like, people were still finding out about it and finding community, and maybe it was even better in some cases. I don't know, but
it's changed.
I would rather be at a 200 person group in real life than on a Facebook forum, that's for sure,
or sitting alone watching YouTube videos, a playlist of, you know, 20 different raw food or vegan videos, but feeling totally disconnected from these people. And you don't know them. You'll never meet them. Like, the community element, I wouldn't be where I am today without that community element. Had I just watched somebody's lectures on YouTube and that was the catalyst for me to switch to a raw diet, I wouldn't have done anything public about it.
That's what I feel about Woodstock. Like, I left Woodstock, like, having met all these people, having seen the vision of, like, here's some people who did it for 20, 30 years or whatever, and thinking, like, that's implanted in my head now. I've been with them, physically beside them, talking to them, watching their body language, their emotion, everything. They're taking all that in and leaving that event with this huge group of people thinking, like, we're all together in this, and I've got all these people, like we're all supporting each other and stuff. And the funny thing is, you go back a year later and so many people aren't back, or they're not into it anymore, or they've went away, they're not even vegan anymore. Like, but in my imagination, like, everyone was doing it. You know, like, I was thinking, like, I wasn't the only one, you know?
Yeah, you know, Ronnie, I am not the right person to do this, simply because I am such an introvert, and the older I get, the more I just want to dive into research and reading and study and philosophy, and experimenting with my body in the world of movement. But I would love to facilitate someone else to bring community back. And this is why I think the fruit festivals are so important, anything like that. It doesn't even matter if it's exactly your cup of tea. You don't need to be a fruitarian to go to the fruit fest of any, you know, whether it's Woodstock, UK, or anywhere else. But just to be around people who are doing something with some degree of alignment, I think is so important. And I want to support that wherever I can, because we're becoming more and more insular. We're just disappearing into our own feeds and data streams and substituting that for the connection that actually makes a difference.
Yeah, I it's still like a, for me, it's like a tribe, you know, and it's like the first time in my life that I was immersed around people that the socializing wasn't alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, you know, and junk food.
Yeah.
And everyone was kind of read a lot, even outside of the raw. Okay, everyone had watched a lot of the same videos and read a lot of the same books. But a lot of people had read a lot of books that weren't raw food related.
Yeah.
They'd read the same personal development stuff, you know, some of the same spiritual stuff, or certain topics people all kind of caught, that had similarities as well. There was quite a lot of symbiosis, or whatever you would call it there. So it's been, but my, kind of why I'm bringing this up a little bit as well is I've tried to have a fruit luck group or a potluck group here, and it never took off. I could get a bunch of people coming now and again, and it would just, and try and keep it going, and it never really got out there. And I don't know what I was doing wrong, or I mean, sometimes I even tried to advertise it, and then I was like, I'm putting money into this, and like, it's all free. Like, I was made it all free, I don't know. It never, but I mean, the festival has worked out, but that's a different thing. So I'm jealous of the people that have had these big potlucks and stuff, because I could never. I always thought like it needs like a beautiful woman at the center of it, or something. Maybe that's what
it doesn't hurt, but not necessarily. So I forget if it's Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point or Outliers. It doesn't matter. It's one of his books. He talks about the character Paul Revere, who outside of the United States, most people probably have no idea who that is. But here in American history, when the British landed in Boston to basically say, we're not letting you be independent, and it was the start of the Revolutionary War, Paul Revere and several other people left Boston on horseback shouting, the redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming, because the British had these red jackets that they wore. And like, they're here, get ready, everybody take your guns and pitchforks and get ready to fight. So we don't know about the people that were not Paul Revere that went out and said the redcoats are coming. But Paul Revere is the one that we all learn about in school. He's the one in the history books, but he was one of many. And so Malcolm Gladwell writes a huge section in this book about Paul Revere type characters. Why do some names get remembered and others not?
Yeah.
And in his analysis of journals and descriptions of Paul Revere, looking at people's letters and communication, he was an extrovert. He was super social. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. And he didn't run through the streets saying, the redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming. He would knock on a door and say, hey, Ronnie, how you doing? It's been a while. Just to let you know, the Brits landed. So, you know, is Martha around? You know, we got, let's, where are the kids? You know, I haven't seen them in a couple of weeks. How are they doing? Let's make sure everybody's, like, he went in and he took care of people. He didn't just simply run through the streets delivering a message. He knew the people, he cared about the people, he attended the people.
Yeah, he was a well-connected person.
He was well-connected.
I think Malcolm Gladwell called that like, there's a name for that, like someone that's like a really well-connected, has a huge network.
Yeah, the only term I remember is the Paul Revere. But there were early adopters, there's some, he had a bunch of names. But the point is, in my experience and observation, groups that have a Paul Revere will grow and succeed. Groups that do not, it doesn't matter what information they're sharing. It doesn't matter the quality of the experience. It doesn't matter how much fun people had. If there's not a Paul Revere at the center, the group will die. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that you have to be the Paul Revere. It means you got to find one.
Yeah. Yeah.
or it could be a Pauline, you know. There's a running group just over the border in New York State, in Albany. So at the festival, you probably fly in and out of Albany or take the train to New York City from Albany. So just over the border from here. And my friend there, Josh, started a running club. And Albany's not a huge city, but his running club now has over 1,200 members in it.
Wow.
1,200 members.
Wow.
Why? Because Josh is an extrovert. Because Josh loves people. Because Josh remembers people's names. Because he's fun and he's always introducing people. And he'd be like, "Hey, Ronnie, do you know Tim? Tim is at that, 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 that. And Ronnie, oh my God, Tim, you would love Ronnie. Ronnie's done this, this, this." And he'll talk for 5 minutes about each of us and then walk away and let us have at it. And he does this all day long for as long as I've
Nice.
known him. And he's built this gigantic community where they're constantly having running potlucks and they put on races together, and he'll get 100 volunteers for each thing that he puts on. Like,
Wow.
they have huge races. There's a gigantic racing community in Albany now because of Josh and the massive volunteer network that he's built to host these events, like world-class events. And watching him and other people like that, Christina Carrillo Bucarem too, in the Houston area,
Sure.
just tirelessly engaging with people and building this gigantic community there. And like, that's not me.
Yeah,
I would
funny.
love to have that community here, but I'm not the guy that builds community. I serve other roles and I serve them well, but I don't fill that role. I'm not right for that role. And that's okay.
Yeah.
So, but you need to find the person that is right for that role and bring them in, and then your community will thrive.
Can you talk about the evolution of the Running Raw project and how that led to YouTube and then how that channel grew and things like that?
Yeah, well, growth doesn't necessarily always mean up. Things can grow in all manner of direction. Evolution isn't always forward.
Yeah.
It started basically as a documentary series chronicling my attempt to, do extraordinary athletic things on a raw vegan diet. But then it became about the talks that I was giving. I would put up a lot of talks, clips from these talks. And the one thing that I kept bumping into again and again at the talks I was giving, a lot of people knew what to eat. They just weren't doing it.
Yeah.
So if you know what to do and you're not doing it, well, what's the missing piece there? So I wanted to try to figure that out. And then I turn the lens around to look at myself and say, well, I'd like to be a better runner, but I'm not doing the training that I know would make me a better runner. Why is that? If I want to do it and I know what it is, why am I not doing it? If I want to be healthier and I know what to eat, but I'm not doing it, why is that? So I started studying psychology and neuroscience and philosophy and Buddhism, and that's been going on for, 15 or more years now. And that's primarily what I do now. And through that process and taking what I've learned and experimenting on myself, I've evolved the Running Raw project into more of a compassionate approach to the things that are in your best interest. Like, how do we take that first step? We know what the step is. We're motivated to take it, and yet it doesn't happen. So I've been trying to build a roadmap to step one. So I had the Getting Started series, which didn't start from a compassionate place, but has evolved into one. So now for me, it's primarily about psychology. Yeah, I can talk about diet if you want. Yes, I can talk about running if you want. But really, what I want to talk about is how. How do you do it? And who's doing it? We have to know who it is that's making the commitment, and we have to know who it is that's taking the step.
But for you, what is the primary, because as you're saying, there's loads of people out there that kind of have an idea of how to eat healthier or live healthier or exercise, or they want to do that. And for the people that grew up like that, that makes sense. Like they've been doing that all their life and all that kind of stuff. But I suppose what you're talking about is the thing of making a change in life. And I've started to learn that it's actually very rare, almost that anyone makes a big change in their life or lifestyle, and that almost very few people, percentage wise of the population, truly want to make a change. Yeah. And what is it that makes that difference for those people that have been able to make that change? Do you have any idea of what are some of the primary reasons why they were able to do that, and when so many people struggle?
Yeah, so we could talk about, I'll use the lens of motivation, but we're going to deviate from that. So in motivation theory, you've got intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So extrinsic motivation, there's something outside that I want. There's an external thing that is pulling me into this. Intrinsic motivation is, I like it. I have a desire to do it. It's an internal drive. The energy or the fuel is coming from inside. I'm compelled to do it versus if I do it, I get something. So intrinsic motivation, I've already got it. I've got the thing, and now I just want to go express it. Extrinsic motivation, I don't have it yet, but if I work really hard, maybe then I'll get the reward. I'll get the gift. So this is how most psychologists would frame this conversation. Where is your motivation coming from? Are you trying to get something at the end of the process, at the finish line? And you believe that there's a reward worth suffering for? Like, what kind of pain do you want? Like, we all have to have pain in our life, and you get to pick what kind of pain you want to have? Is it that method? Or are you simply compelled to do it? And if you're compelled to do it, well, maybe then it's a matter of you just don't know about it yet. I'm already compelled to be healthy. I just don't know that veganism exists until I watch a YouTube video. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. And suddenly I'm vegan the next day. Or I'm raw or fruitarian because I just didn't know that even was a thing. But now that I watched a couple videos, well, why wouldn't I do that? I'm compelled to do things that are good for my body. There's no discipline or willpower necessary. So the first lens to look at it is, where is it that the motivation is coming from? Is the motivation in alignment with something that already exists inside you intrinsically? I have a desire to be healthy, and it's just a matter of learning more about what brings about health, and then I'll just keep making a correction as I discover newer and better things that guide me down that path. Or is it the desire to change something, the extrinsic, like I hate myself. I hate the fact that I feel like crap all the time. I hate my body. I want to transform it. I want to look like that guy or girl over there. Or, you know, I want more money, or I want a better relationship. I want people to like me. And if I do this and I really put the time in, then maybe I can get that result. And there's plenty of people that will promise that you will get that result, and they'll charge you for it. So number one, where's the motivation coming from? Number two, which I think is even more important, and this is where the bulk of my research and communication and coaching is now focused. Who is it that's going after it? So this goes back to what I was sharing earlier in this conversation, that identity is just one aspect of who and what we are. And if you have a fragile identity, you're going to constantly want to prove something. You're going to constantly need to increase your rank somehow, or at least desperately maintain your rank, because you're scared to death of falling off the bottom of the group. So how do I stay in this group? How do I keep people interested? How do I get more people interested? How do I get that person to like me or want to be with me or want to do business with me? So as an insecure person, I could put an athletic goal out there that's about proving something, and it's all driven by identity. So it's extrinsic. But what I do now is just allow my body and who I am as a being outside of identity. I can think, I can operate, I can function, I can have this conversation without needing to protect or establish an identity. I can just talk about concepts. I can talk about who you are and raw food and exercise, whatever, but I don't need to care about how it's being perceived by anyone. And the moment you care about what other people think, you're inside your identity. The moment you're wondering, well, what if they, are they going to like what I have to say? You're inside your identity. If you don't care if anybody likes it, you're outside of your identity. So if I can set an athletic goal outside of identity, simply out of curiosity, what happens if I do this for 6 months? Why 6 months? I don't know. It's an arbitrary number. Why this particular training? I don't know. That's also arbitrary. It's an experiment. But wouldn't it be interesting to find out what would happen if I did that for 6 months? Let's find out. I'm curious. That's exciting. It's a brand new thing. I've never seen anyone train like this before. I may fail miserably, but I will have learned something, so it doesn't matter. And I didn't really fail miserably because there's no identity to be miserable or to rate it as a failure. I simply collected data. Identities want to know, did I succeed or fail? Outside of identity, it's like, well, what data did I collect? And how can I use that data to inform the next step that I take? Okay, great. I spent 6 months doing that. I did see some benefit here, here, and here. So I'm going to take those pieces and incorporate them into another experiment. And I'll try that for 6 months. And I'll take the pieces that are valuable and I'll incorporate those into another experiment. Meanwhile, identity's like, yeah, yeah, but you're not winning anymore. So I'm learning, I'm growing, I'm enjoying this, it's fun.
Yeah.
There is no disappointment. So when it comes to succeeding, is it internal or external? And who wants it and why?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the difference between these two types of goals, the curiosity experimental goal and the identity needing to maintain or improve its rank.
Right.
The identity doesn't benefit until the desired result is achieved. But even then, that identity is going to discover that the life-changing end of the rainbow pot of gold doesn't actually exist. And you're just going to have to jump through those hoops all over again, hoping that maybe two national championships will finally tip the scales. Oh, maybe three. It's got to be 10. Oh, God, maybe 15? Or if we step outside of that and say, well, I don't care if I win. I don't care if I'm 20th place. I just love playing in this arena. I love exploring my body in the midst of movement. I love trying training modalities that are non-standard and seeing what the result is. It's fun to collect all this data. And every now and then, I will hop in a race to test it out. Is it working or not? I'm going to find out next weekend at the New England Cross Country Running Championships. I barely run anymore, maybe once or twice a week. And that's rare that I run once or twice a week. Many weeks, I don't run at all. But I do all this other kind of training. And it's fun to show up to a running race with 100 hours in my legs for the month of October. And see what I can do.
Yeah.
And there's no expectation and there's no failure. So when it comes to diet or anything else, is there the possibility of failure? If there is, it's not going to work.
Sure.
So if you've set it up as a game that you can lose, it's not going to work. If you've set it up that it requires willpower, it's not going to work. Because willpower is a very limited resource.
Recording stopped.
Can we pause there 1 second?
Yeah.
I just want to quickly...
What time is it? Oh, yeah.
But how much time have you got left, roughly?
Well, how much time do you want to talk, Ronnie? Go ahead. Go to the bathroom and okay. We've almost gone on 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm absolutely happy to do another 20 minutes.
Okay, let's do another 20 minutes.
Okay.
Recording in progress.
Well, bearing in mind what you've just said there, could you maybe talk about, I was pretty blown away when I heard you say that you had the American record for the road mile for 50 plus.
Yeah.
and I couldn't, and I was like, when you said that, I was like, is that what he's, I was trying to figure out, like, is that what he's saying? Is that what he really means? Like, isn't that like an incredibly high achievement or whatever? So what was the training like for that? Like, had you set that intention? Like, well, how does all this fit in with that happening, for example?
So this is a hard thing to talk about because it would be really easy to take credit for it. And it would be really easy for people to hear me being proud of myself, which I'm not. So I want to be very careful when I talk about this because I think it's incredibly useful and I'm still learning from it. So in 2019, I was not running much. And I've had a series of injuries that have been with me since 2013, bone spurs in both Achilles tendons. I have arthritis in my left ankle. I break toes on a regular basis, trail running, kicking rocks and roots. Lots of different things have occurred that have made running more and more problematic over time, which is why I've transitioned into cross-country skiing, less impact. So in 2019, I was running a little bit, and went to Sweden for the month of June, July, I forget, a good chunk of the summer. And I was walking a lot there with my girlfriend. She's not a runner, so I couldn't run and have her next to me. So I was doing my Bigfoot walk, which is something that I developed in 2017, again, at another period of injury. It's how you walk when you're filming something. Like in California, the Steadicam operators, they're people that they walk around with cameras and they do a certain kind of walk to keep the camera from bouncing up and down. And you're kind of you're not in a full lunge, you're in like a 30% lunge and you heel toe with a lot of tension on your quads and your glutes. And the goal is you don't want your head to bob at all. You want your head to be perfectly steady as you're walking. And that way the camera is not going to be going like this up and down. So I was filming trails in Vermont. I did that walk for months. And then my team asked me to jump in a 5K. This is 2017. And I said, hey, I'm not running at all. And they're like, yeah, we need a third guy for the team. We don't care. Just show up. We need a third guy for the team. It's the U.S. Championships. We think maybe we can get a bronze medal if you're 20th place. So I went to the race really having low expectations. And I ran a 15:57 for 5K. So I was 49 years old, 2017. I was 49. And I hadn't been running. And
For people that don't run, and I'm not a very up to the running times, but I think that that's a pretty great time.
That's a very solid time. In fact, it got me, I think I got the bronze medal in the 45 to 49 age group. I think I got the bronze. Mm-hmm. So it's national caliber running. And they do what they call age grading. So they take world champions in their 20s at any age, And then they do a statistical regression analysis of their times as they age. Like somebody that was the world record holder at 24, how fast do they run at 28, at 35, at 40? And you can track, and okay, well, what is the world record at 40 in this particular event? And how does that compare to a 23-year-old world record holder who slowed down over the course of their career? So they project out and do what they call an age grading. So 1557 age grades into the 13 minute something. So that is basically, you know, almost Olympic caliber. So it's fast. It's super fast. To break 16 minutes in 5K is an accomplishment. And I did it without running. So that was like a big switch that went off in my head, but it was one data point. So I've been experimenting with this Bigfoot walk, I call it, because you look like the videos of Bigfoot walking through the woods, because you're kind of low to the ground and your arms are hanging really low because your knees are bent. So it looks like you have super long arms, like you're an ape walking through the forest. So that's why I call it the Bigfoot. And you take long strides. Anyway.
Just a total aside, what do you think about Bigfoot?
Nah! I don't know.
other people where you are that have seen that or believe in that or anything?
No, but when I was out in the Pacific Northwest giving some talks, one of the people that would host me on a regular basis and set up many of the talks that I gave there, her husband partner is like the head of the Bigfoot Association in the Pacific Northwest. He's like, he's the guy.
Right.
I got to hear all the stories and look at all the evidence that they had. And I'm inconclusive. I don't know enough to have an opinion on it.
Right. Okay.
Do I think that there are creatures in the world that we haven't discovered yet? Absolutely. You know, do we know everything about every living thing on Earth? Hell no. We don't even know how we work yet. You know, I mean, the human body is still a mystery to the human body. So this Bigfoot walk, I've been experimenting with it since 2017 because that was such a huge result. Mm-hmm.